Hello and welcome to New Books in Eastern European Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. My name is Jelena Golubovic, and today I will be talking with Ivan Simic about his very new book, which just came out this year, 2018, from Palgrave Macmillan. The book is called Soviet Influences on Postwar Yugoslav Gender Policies. When communists came to power in Yugoslavia after World War II, they based their new system on the Soviet model. They initially looked towards the Soviet Union as a kind of socialist utopia and that they hoped to achieve in Yugoslavia. But after the split between Tito and Stalin over foreign policy disagreements in 1948, Yugoslav communists had to carve their own path forward. So Ivan Simic's new book looks at this historical moment through the lens of gender policies. He asks, how did the Soviet model influence Yugoslav gender policies after World War II? What were the many challenges of applying these policies in the Yugoslav context? And what happened to Yugoslav gender policies after the Tito-Stalin split? So, Ivan, I hope this was an adequate introduction to your exciting new book, and thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
The first question I'd like to ask you is just to tell us about yourself and how you came to write this book.
Well, I'm currently a postdoc fellow at Carleton University in Ottawa, in Canada. Before that, I was briefly at the University of Calgary, and that was after finishing my PhD at University College London in the UK, where I actually did most of the research for this book. And this book actually originates in my PhD thesis that I did during my time in England at UCL and CIS. It was a product of, now around 6 years of researching and writing. So it was a quite long process. But in a sense, it was also an evolution of my previous projects that I did for my BA and MA thesis. So, namely for my MA thesis, I was actually looking at the constructions of masculinity and femininity in early Yugoslav socialism, and then it actually came to me that a lot of things that were happening immediately after the Second World War in socialist Yugoslavia were heavily influenced by the Soviet Union, and then I was going further and further, and that was the starting point for the research. So it was, in a sense, an evolution that ended in this book.
Great. So just to make sure that the listeners are on the same page sort of going forward, since I've already had the pleasure of reading this book. But we'll be talking a lot about the sort of Soviet model, Soviet gender policies, or more particularly Stalinist gender policies for around the time that the Yugoslav communists were coming into power. So could you just explain briefly for the listeners, what were Stalinist gender policies?
Okay, so the thing is that Stalinist gender policies at its core were very complex. And for me and for this particular research, it wasn't really important of what were Stalinist gender policies, either in theory and practice in the Soviet Union, but rather how Yugoslav communists perceived Stalinist gender policies, how they learned them during the 1930s while when the majority of Yugoslav communists, particularly the leadership, were actually educated in the Soviet Union. And so that was the most important thing of how they perceived Stalinist gender policies. And when I'm talking about Stalinist gender policies and their application in socialist Yugoslavia, I'm talking about how they were seen by Yugoslav communists, how they were adopted and then applied in Yugoslav practice. Of course, it is important in a sense of what Stalinist gender policies were in the Soviet Union, but mostly on that on the level of public discourses that were present in the Soviet Union during the 1930s. So also Stalinist gender policies have received significant attention in historiography. Although recently there is a shift in how Stalinist gender policies are perceived, namely during the 1980s and early 1990s, for most of the social historians, Stalinist gender policies were seen as kind of a great retreat, meaning that it was some kind of retreat from more open, more, so to say, liberal gender policies of the Soviet Union in the immediate post-revolutionary period of the 1970s and then during the 1920s. And historians mostly used the arguments that with the ascent of Stalinism, there were new family laws, which actually attempt to reinforce family structures. For example, divorce became more actually harder to obtain in the 1930s than in the 1920s in the Soviet Union. And also the way that masculinity and femininity were formulated in public discourse were more, so to say, or at least it was claimed to be more conservative than during the 1920s. Also, for example, abortion was banned again in 1936 in the Soviet Union. So all these things actually were used as the arguments that there was indeed retreat in terms of gender policies in the Soviet Union. However, more recently, few gender historians, for example, Elizabeth Wood and also David Hoffman, but he's not a gender historian, but anyway, they try to show that Stalinism as such was not a retreat, and that Stalinist gender policies were certainly different than in the 1920s, but that they were not a retreat, neither in its intention or in its consequences. They were equally revolutionary, and the retreat would mean, for example, returning to the pre-revolutionary state, which certainly was not the intention of Stalin's gender policies. Also, Elizabeth Wood, for example, showed that even during the 1920s, and gender policies were considered to be more open and free and liberal, that even then, not many Bolshevik leaders were very interested in gender equality, and that there were many other concerns that occupied the Bolshevik leadership, and that what was promoted in public discourse was equally sharp distinction of what was appropriate femininity and what was appropriate masculinity, and so on. So that actually that retreat was not sharp as it was previously claimed. And now we are coming to Yugoslav communists, but also other Eastern European revolutionaries who were in Moscow during the 1930s, is that they actually never noticed any retreat in gender policies. And one argument that I'm using is that even after 1948 and after the conflict with the Soviet Union, even then, when Yugoslav communists tried to at least rhetorically distance themselves from Stalinism, they never observed that there was a retreat in gender policies during the 1930s. So in a sense, Stalinist gender policies that Yugoslav communists adopted were a mixture of what was happening in the Soviet Union during the 1920s and what was happening during the 1930s, and how they actually interpreted those gender policies. Yeah,
I think one of the good things about your book, when you're talking about the Yugoslav case, is you don't give this view that, after communism, gender policies were just, better and better and better, that it actually was so much of a back and forth, and progress was made and then sort of taken away depending on these sort of micropolitics happening within the party. But before we go into talking more about what Yugoslav gender policies look like after World War II, could you explain for the listeners what gender policies and gender relations look like in Yugoslavia before World War II, or sort of in the interwar period?
That's another important thing, that no matter how gender policies in the Soviet Union were during the Stalinist period, they were not conservative at all as compared to what was the dominant in interwar Yugoslavia. So, namely, Yugoslavia was formed in 1918, and economically, it was very underdeveloped. Politically as well. In terms of, for example, gender policies, women did not have any political, economic, or even social rights. But also, interwar Yugoslavia was a sort of legal mess, so to say, because There were no attempts to make uniform legislation for the entire country, meaning that, for example, in Serbian part of Yugoslavia, and in terms of gender relations, that's quite important, the old Serbian civil law from 1844 was still in use. And according to that law, women were legally equalized with minors and without any political social rights, while men were pretty much openly, that's how it was framed, were defined to be heads of the family and those who are to decide about pretty much everything regarding women's lives. In other parts of Yugoslavia, there was also old Austrian civil law, which was equally unfavorable to women. For Muslim population, there was Sharia law in power, and only in very small part of northern Yugoslavia, in Vojvodina, there was all Hungarian civil law in power, which is interesting because that's the only one which allowed divorce to exist. So this entire mess actually meant that divorce was super hard to obtain in pretty much the entire country, that interreligious marriages were very rare, and for the entire country, women did not have any political and economic rights. Also, for the vast majority of the country, women also did not have, so to say, educational rights, meaning that many universities and many degrees were closed to women, they were not giving them diplomas, and so on. So pretty much every single, even if we accept that there was a retreat in Stalinist gender policies, that would still be very progressive and very radical in no matter what form it was applied in Yugoslavia later.
Yes, I remember feeling quite shocked when I read some of the laws you mentioned were in place in the interwar period. And I think given how conservative so many of these laws were, and given the huge mix, as you mentioned, of which laws were being applied in which parts of Yugoslavia, it makes sense that when the communists came to power and attempted to, you know, enforce a sort of unified system, that there was a lot of resistance, not only in the local level, but within the party, to many of the gender policies they are putting forward. I'd love if you could talk a little bit about the problem of resistance. Maybe we could separate sort of the local level resistance versus the resistance within the party, whichever you'd like to address first, I guess.
Well, Yugoslav communists started changing the society immediately once the Second World War started. So just to introduce the listeners, the Second World War in Yugoslavia started in 1941, and the Yugoslav Communist Party at that time was not really big, but very well organized conspiratory organization, which was working underground for previous 20 years because it was outlawed in interwar Yugoslavia. And they were actually quite ready when the Second World War started. They had a very clear idea of what kind of society they wanted to build upon the Soviet model. And once Yugoslavia was occupied, they were just waiting for the direction from Moscow to start the armed uprising against the occupiers. And that actually happened in June 1941, when Germany invaded the Soviet Union. And immediately after that summer of 1941, Yugoslav communists started to radically change the societies. And already in early 1942, they made this so-called Focha Ordinance, which for the first time gave equal political rights to women in the partisan communist units, meaning that for the first time, Yugoslav women could vote and be elected for different posts in the liberated areas. And already then, during the war, Yugoslav communists in the liberated areas started organizing something called the People's Councils, which were administrative ruling units in the liberated areas, and they expected women to be elected as well. And already during the war in 1942 and 1943, we can see that there were resistances, in particularly in very remote areas, for women to be elected into these people's councils. But we can also see that Yugoslav communists have a very proactive stance of criticizing this kind of resistances to women's participation. And that was quite important because in the liberated areas, those who were elected in those councils were mostly elderly men and women. So meaning that they were actually radically challenging all patriarchal structures that existed. So that was at a very local level. I mean, in the book, I'm showing that there were various levels of resistance to applying the Soviet models, be it at a very local level, but also within the levels of the Communist Party. And one important thing, at least I think it's important, is that I show how the very structures of the Communist Party helped that resistance in the sense that they excluded women from the top levels of the Communist Party and the top levels where the major decisions were made. So what happened during the war already 1942 was that Yugoslav communists organized its own women's section called the Anti-Fascist Women's Front. And that organization's tightly close to the party was supposed to organize all Yugoslav women so that they would support war efforts during the war, but also that they would have very strong educational role. And what I'm arguing is that first that organization was modeled upon the Soviet Zhenodel, which was the women's section of the Bolshevik Party in the 1920s. And I'm also showing that the very fact that from the beginning of the war, Yugoslav communists considered women to be a special case or those who need special attention and those who are not default warriors, revolutionaries, and even citizens, but those who actually require to have a separate organization, that by designing something like that, they deliberately channeled women's political activity within such organization, and which seriously impeded their political activities through the party and at the very top levels of the leadership. So there were multiple levels of resistance.
This anti-fascist women's front you mentioned, it's such an interesting case. You also discuss how they were sort of, I mean, they were excluded from the top levels of the party structure, but they were also mandated with taking care of social issues and not more political or foreign policy related issues. What were some of the social issues that they were handling, and what kind of changes were they able to actually affect through this organization?
So that was from the very beginning, I think, imagined to be an organization that would help for broader goals of the party. And since the party organized the society in a very hierarchical I mean, the system they organized is usually called political monism, in which there was only one political party, and there was also something called People's Front, which was ruled by the Communist Party, and all these mass, so-called mass organizations, including the Anti-Fascist Women's Front, were part of that People's Front, meaning that they were pretty much ruled by the party and following all the party's policies. And already when it was clear that the war is coming to an end in 1944 and early 1945, the Anti-Fascist Women's Front was directed towards more social issues. First of taking care of hundreds of thousands of homeless children and of children of fallen fighters and so on. They also had a very important role in those first years of just very basic things of trying to organize supplies in the cities, in the countryside, and so on. And later, whenever the party needed some kind of broader support from women, for example, regarding industrialization, regarding the conflict with the Soviet Union or collectivization of the countryside, they would call the anti-fascist women's front to work with women and to ensure that the party is supported amongst the women. And that was also one of the reasons why I think, at least, that the anti-fascist women front contributed to that exclusion of women from political decision making. Of course, the other reason was that I'm not really sure that there was ever any desire by the top levels of Yugoslav Communist Party's leadership to include more women into the forums where the real political and economic decisions were made. And since it was a very hierarchical structure leading to Josip Broz Tito at the very top, it was Josip Broz Tito and his closest mates who were Rankovic, Kardelj, and Gilas, and then leading to the Politburo of the Communist Party, and there were no women in the Politburo of the Communist Party, and then leading to the Central Committee of the Communist Party, and they're just going down through the structures. And in these structures, there were a very limited number of women. For example, in the Central Committee after the war, there were only two women who were admitted in 1940, Vida Tomšić and Spasenija Babović, and even they were often forced to work on the so-called women's issues. First Spasenija Babović and Vida Tomšić were both presidents of this anti-fascist women's front. So.
And it might be good to clarify here, you discuss in your book that, I mean, the anti-fascist women's front, even though it was charged with women's issues and with, you know, the emancipation of women in society and so forth, it really couldn't be called a feminist organization. And you discuss some sort of internal debates between women, some who were taking a feminist stance, others who were sticking to sort of the party line. Could you clarify a bit sort of the difference between a feminist organization and a communist gender organization?
Yeah, so the organization was super important to so many women, and it was huge. At some point, it had more than 1 million women in its ranks. It had offices in very remote areas, in very rural villages, and the organization provided very valuable support to women who wanted to be part of the new socialist regime and who wanted to show that they're good communists and so on. And the organization actually had many campaigns which were very valuable for so many people, including anti-literacy campaigns and so on. But there was this discussion more recently, actually, which I consider to be quite anachronistic. We try to show that the anti-fascist women front was some sort of feminist organization. My argument is that the organization itself was modeled upon the Soviet Genodel, and that for the leaders of the AFG, which is the acronym of the organization, that for the leaders of the organization, being called a feminist would be very insulting in the first place. That is that old division between Bolsheviks and feminists since the beginning of the 20th century, pretty much. And already during the 1930s, it was very clear in Yugoslavia as well. There were discussions within the AFG about feminism, and actually being accused of being a feminist within the organization would be quite serious offense. Now, the goals that, let's say, pre-Second World War feminist organizations in Yugoslavia had were quite similar with some of the goals of the anti-fascist women's front, namely they all advocated for women's political and economic rights. Pre-war feminist organizations also organized many campaigns directed at peasant women regarding literacy or health campaigns and so on. But the major difference was that leading Yugoslav communist women, who were also leading YFŽ, were seeing the solutions to these questions solely on the Soviet model. And that could not include any form of feminism, basically on ideological reasons. For example, Vida Tomšić, who was one of the most important Yugoslav women of the 1940s and 1950s, always claimed that, and that was the old argument, always claimed that feminism actually separates women from the working class and that that has no place in Yugoslav socialism. I also argued that such stances, which were quite negative towards even the very word feminism, had marks in socialist Yugoslavia up until late 1970s, that this whole generation of communist women, Vida Tomšić, Pasenia Balović, they could not relate to what was happening, for example, in Western Europe in 1970s, and that only a new generation of Yugoslav women who had nothing to do with YFŽ organized themselves mostly in Zagreb and Ljubljana and Belgrade in late 1970s to start a new feminist movement. But that new feminist movement had nothing to do with the period that I'm talking about, and there was a quite sharp contrast in how they saw each other. So I think that this entire these attempts to connect AFEJ with later late Yugoslav or post-Yugoslav feminisms were kind of useful, maybe for contemporary feminist circles, but they are quite ahistorical. Mm-hmm.
And this argument that feminism separates women from the working class, it's interesting because this is the type of argument that was used to shut down the organization, correct? The anti-fascist women?
That's correct. I mean, the very existence of the AFEJ was contested from the very beginning, since already during the 1943, there was a debate of why in the communist units, there were debates of why they have a separate women's organization while women are equal in the partisan unit and they're going to be equal in a new socialist country. The same ideological reasons were always there after the Second World War and the discussions why do we need a separate women's organization. One argument for having it was also that on the levels of something that they might use often, which was called socialist consciousness, women were always lagging behind men. And that since women were so backward, and particularly peasant women and so on, that there is a need for a separate women's organization who will work with these women so that they will catch up with men on the, that imagined hierarchy of socialist consciousness. And then once the socialism is fully built, there will be no need for having a separate female organization. These were all ideological arguments, and they were actually used in 1953 when the AFEJ was dismantled. Namely, Milovan Zilas said, the AFEJ Congress said that there is no need for separate female organization, that they should work together on political issues, that they can organize the decentralized female societies to work on specific issues, for example, regarding children and social care and so on. But that on political levels, there is no need for a separate female organization. And it's quite interesting because Lazar Kaganovich from the Soviet Union used completely the same arguments in 1930 when they dismantled Zhenodel in the Soviet Union. So the ideological reasons were quite important. But they also argued that the AFEJ created many enemies, particularly among the lower rank-and-file men and communist men, with their own activities, and particularly when they attempt to challenge at the local level all patriarchal hierarchies, that that also contributed that the AFEJ was not very popular amongst men as well. So, yeah, I guess it makes sense.
I'm happy you brought up these hierarchies in the socialist imagination. I do have a question about that I'd like to ask you in a minute. But first, I wanted to ask you about motherhood and sort of the role of women as mothers in socialist ideology. Because as you mentioned, during World War II, women fought in the partisan movement. After the war, they were physically called on to rebuild destroyed infrastructure. They moved into industry jobs after the war that had previously been closed to them or just been considered male realms. So communism gave a lot of new roles for women. But soon after the war, the role of women as mothers began to be emphasized again. And this some of the jobs that had become open to them then became closed to them. So I'd love if you could elaborate on sort of this tension between the roles that women were assigned.
I think that the issue of motherhood was quite important even during the war. It is true, and it's quite an interesting phenomenon that so many women participated in armed struggles of the Yugoslav partisans, and many of them actually were in combats and earning officer ranks and medals and so on. But already during the war in 1944, if you read publications, for example, particularly directed at women, we can see that they often wrote about the Soviet Union and what the Soviet Union was doing for the protection of mothers and children and motherhood in general. There were articles, for example, that motherhood is the backbone of the Soviet Union and so on. So I cannot say that they ever put the issue of motherhood on the side. I think that first of all, for Yugoslav partisans and for Yugoslav communists, it was naturalized and normal that women had that how they saw it, the biological role of being mothers. And already in 1945, we can see from Josip Broz Tito's speeches that motherhood would be quite important and that it should be quite important and high on the priorities of the women's, of the party's women's section, and that motherhood was on equal footing with the reconstruction of the country and so on. So that is another thing that I'm bringing in the book, that it's that there was no, so to put it, re-traditionalization of Yugoslav communists after the split with the Soviet Union and with the Yugoslav self-management. On the contrary, that motherhood was always placed quite high by communist men, namely by Josip Broz Tito, and that he was often the one who was deciding on what kind of gender role and to what extent Yugoslav women can and are out and are allowed to challenge existing gender hierarchies. So the issue of motherhood was there from the very beginning. Also, if you look at the Yugoslav constitution of 1946, it was heavily modeled on the Soviet Constitution of 1936, and many articles that concerned it, motherhood and protections of mothers and children were direct Soviet translations. And so the new thing was that the state, in this case, guaranteed protection of mothers and children, so putting it very high at the state priorities. And also it's very basic premise then informed how, for example, labor laws were formulated. It also informed of how the women's section approached collectivization, for example. It also informed how they approached youth sexuality and how they saw sexuality in general. And so the way that motherhood and fatherhood was actually very rarely mentioned, So it was mostly about motherhood and the new generation of Yugoslav communists, which was a duty of women and not really of men.
Yeah, you make a great point in your book that in this way, the state sort of seemed to use women in this opportunistic way where when they needed hard labor done, they would ask women to step forward and do the hard labor. And later when they needed, you know, more attention towards, or I guess they never stopped needing attention towards, but when it became reemphasized, the importance of child rearing and so on and so forth.
No, the country was heavily devastated during the Second World War. Apart from Poland and Germany, but out of allied countries, I don't think, and the Soviet Union, I don't think that any country was so devastated. And the party engaged in rapid reconstruction first, and then in 1947, they launched very, very optimistic industrialization project based on the Soviet model. And they assumed that they would need every single capable worker to be very engaged in industrialization. And since they pretty much lacked any mechanization for that, they had to rely on crude workforce. So they also assumed that that there would be a shortage of male workforce, and that they had to engage and bring more women into industry. And that actually opened many, many possibilities for women in 1946 and 1947 and 1948 as well, during this period of rapid industrialization. Many women found employment in jobs that were previously, particularly in the interwar Yugoslavia, completely unimaginable that women would work there. And also industrial schools had to open places for female youth and so on. But at the same time, as you mentioned, there was always this thing that women were supposed to be mothers as well, besides being workers. And even during this industrialization push, we can read from the internal reports that the party cells and the party organizers were supposed to pay more attention to what women are doing in these jobs, or how is their accommodation and so on, much more attention than what was paid to men. Meaning that they saw women as first more expensive and kind of different workforce than men. And then when the economy, after the conflict with the Soviet Union and the blockade from the East, and the economy kind of contracted, women were the first to lose jobs. And then we can actually see how these patriarchal stances were not really challenged, and local level, so for example, for the local unions, where many union leaders actually saw it normal that married women should be fired first if there is if there are too many people employed in the factory, and then other women, and only at the end that men could lose their jobs.
It's probably a good moment to come back to this idea of the sort of symbolic hierarchy that the communists had. And it's quite a complicated one. I mean, between, on the one hand, men and women, between peasants and urbanites, and between the religious Muslim population and everybody else. So you sort of describe that in this hierarchy, the peasants were low, female peasants were even lower, and Muslim female peasants were the lowest. And there's one chapter in your book devoted to a very contentious veil lifting campaign that the Yugoslav leadership implemented as part of their campaign to spread socialism and strengthen socialism in the countryside. So I'd love if you could discuss a little bit the banning of the veil and why this was important for the communists, and then how it was received by the Muslim communities for which the veil was an important religious practice.
Okay, so first, regarding the hierarchies, the Communist Party saw itself as the vanguard of the working class, whose duty is to lead all other forward to socialism and communism. So they are at the top of that hierarchy. After that, of course, there was this gender hierarchy between men and women. There was also a hierarchy of places, meaning that no matter what was happening in the cities, they were always assumed and considered to be more advanced to backward countryside. And there was also that class hierarchy that workers are more advanced than peasants. And when we put all these together, we can see that the male workers were at the top of that hierarchy and female peasants were at the bottom. Now, there was also a sort of a religious hierarchy, namely, which saw that Muslim women were the most backward group in the country. And I mean, when I'm talking about this advanced and backward, I'm always talking the way the communists saw them. So they saw Muslim women to be humiliated by all traditions. They saw Muslim women to be the most exploited group in the country, who were not only exploited by the fact that they were living in a very underdeveloped countryside, but that they were also exploited by very patriarchal religious practices. At least that's how Yugoslav communists saw them. Another issue was that I think that Yugoslav communists did not have much contact with Muslim women themselves. I think that the communities were quite close to them. And there was this a strong desire that the vanguard of the working class, meaning the Communist Party, should lead the entire society forward and that no group was to be left behind. That also applied to Muslim women. Another problem with Muslim communities was that many, not all, but many Muslim women in Yugoslavia wore the veils, which in Yugoslav case was mostly full face and body covering. That was something that was not really acceptable to Yugoslav communists. And they also read about, and we can also see in their translations of Soviet documents, they read about tremendous successes that supposedly the Soviet Union had in Central Asia, about the unveiling of Muslim women there, who were then given the opportunity to be parts of the socialist projects, and then who made really fruitful careers and so on. And since Yugoslav communists were never in any case less ambitious than their Soviet mentors, they pretty much expected the same to happen in socialist Yugoslavia. Now, Yugoslav communists started first unveiling attempts already in 1946 and 1947, but from the internal reports, we can see that these attempts were very unsuccessful, that not many Muslim women wanted to unveil, that many would veil again as soon as the activists leave the villages, and so on. Now, regarding the Islamic community in Yugoslavia, which is quite specific because there was this quite organized structure which was supposed to be equivalent to, let's say, the structures of Serbian Orthodox Church or the Catholic Church and so on, the Islamic community in Yugoslavia was led by Reisul Ulema, and that was re-established in 1947. And interestingly, the Islamic community of Yugoslavia had quite good relationships with the party. And there were several reasons for that. First, the Islamic community was no longer discriminated to more dominant Serbian Orthodox Church or to the Catholic Church. Second reason was that Yugoslav Communist Party provided quite significant monetary donations to the Islamic community in return for support, and they also installed their own communists in many of the posts. And finally, there was another thing that should be mentioned, is that there was a very strong, of how they saw it, modernist tradition within the Islamic community of Yugoslavia. Already in the 1920s, there were many debates within the Islamic community about unveiling of Muslim women with Reisul Ulema Čaušević, who strongly supported unveiling of Muslim women. Not much was done on that in the interwar period, but it's important to see that there was the evolution and there was support for unveiling within the Muslim community. After the Second World War, Reisul Ulema was Ibrahim Efendi Fejić, who was also in favor of unveiling, and the Communist Party used that extensively, making sure that his views were seen. But even that didn't really ensure that unveiling was really happening in practice. So what Yugoslav communists did was to ban wearing the veils. Now, that is quite different than the Soviet Union, because the Soviets never really banned veils. There were attempts in the Soviet Union in the 1920s, Soviet Kudrum, and maybe 1937, to pretty much remove the veils from the public space, but they were never banned. Yugoslav communists so went a step further, and in 1950, they banned wearing the veils. And it was so done by the law, meaning that not only women who wore the veil could be punished, but also men who, by any mean, put any pressure on women to wear the veil. That also gave the activists a very powerful tool to launch very aggressive veil lifting campaign, and that happened all over Yugoslavia in 1950. And in a very short period, veils disappeared from public space in Yugoslavia. Initially, it created huge problems as well, because many women locked themselves in the houses. Once again, Yugoslav communists interpreted that it was actually Muslim men who were not allowing women to go outside and so on. But actually, when we read internal reports, we can see that many women actually didn't have anything to wear after unveiling, that many women were just very ashamed to show up on the street unveiled and so on. And that it wasn't only due to the men's pressure, as it was publicized by Yugoslav communists. But anyway, the result of that unveiling campaign was that veils pretty much disappeared from Yugoslav countryside and also from Yugoslav cities, and that Muslim women kind of adapted to the situation, now wearing scarves and so on. So, yeah, that was a quite important step for, at least in my interpretation, for Yugoslav communists, for state-building purposes, that it allowed the party to intervene into the communities that were previously close to them, and then using gender relations pretty much as a pretext for broader interventions into these communities.
Thank you so much for that overview. I feel like we've taken a lot of your time, so I only want to ask you another question, departing sort of from this book, which is, what are you working on now? What are some future projects coming up for you?
Well, I'm expanding on this entire unveiling issue. That is part of my postdoc now at Carleton. I'm looking at the Bulgarian case as well, and comparing Yugoslav and Bulgarian case, and also returning to the Soviet Union, trying to see more direct connections with the Soviet case in Central Asia, because now it seems to me that Moscow was really a hub for both Yugoslav and Bulgarian revolutionaries, and that they didn't really know what was happening in Central Asia, but that they had some ideas of how the society should be organized and how policies toward Muslim communities should be. So that is the big project that I'm doing now. There are also some smaller projects that are kind of left from my book. One of them is looking more at other religious communities and how gender policies of Yugoslav communists challenge other religious communities, namely the Catholic Church and Serbian Orthodox Church, and how clergy try to counter communist policies at a very local level, and how they try to also negotiate gender policies that were enforced to them and to adapt to the situation. And the third project, also deriving from that, is on how Yugoslav approaches towards prostitution And particularly in the first few years after the Second World War, informed how prostitution was seen during the entire socialist period.
Wow, all three of those projects sounds fascinating. You must be very, very busy at the moment then.
Well, yeah.
But I really look forward to reading this future work that you're going to put out. And thanks again so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
That was Ivan Simic talking to us about his book, Soviet Influences on Postwar Yugoslav Gender Policies, which came out this year, 2018, from Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you for listening.